Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Back from the brink, New York Community Bancorp getting a $1 billion lifeline from the former Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin 1 year after SVB failed. How did another major bank almost blow up? We'll have the very latest. Plus, the battle over bulge. Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb set to weigh in on the call for the government to step in and get prices lowered for these wildly popular and effective obesity drugs. And later, Tim is pumping up the L in his bicep trade. Topping the tape on a big Chinese tech name. And two left feet, the reasons why Foot Locker dropped almost 30% today. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq on the desk tonight. Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Steve Grosso, and Savita Subramanian, head of U.S. equity strategy for Bank of America, B of A. Markets, meantime, managing gains across the board as investors look to recoup some of yesterday's losses. Though all three indices did close well off the day's highs, Fed Chair Jerome Powell reiterating that the central bank is not ready to cut rates just yet. We'll get more on that in just a few minutes. But we start off with a last-minute lifeline for New York Community Bancorp. Shares were down as much as 42% today before the regional lender announced it had secured a $1 billion investment led by the firm of former Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. After several trading halt, shares managed to close the day higher, 7.5%. That is less than 25 cents higher, I should say. For the latest details, let's get straight to Leslie Pinker, who joins us here on set. What a roller coaster day today.
Oh, my gosh. It was a fascinating turn of events for this company, New York Community Bancorp, inking a deal for $1 billion from a group of investors led by former Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's firm, Liberty Strategic Capital. Those investors buying common and convertible preferred stock, $2 per share. Investors will also get a 60% warrant coverage to buy more stock with an exercise price of $250. A bit of background on how this all came together, according to people familiar with the matter. Secretary Mnuchin had been involved here diligencing NYCB for a while now. I'm told Jefferies approached a select group of other investors with the prospect of a capital raise on Sunday. They were told that a lead investor, Mnuchin's firm, had put up $450 million. Ultimately, investors, including Hudson Bay Capital, Reverence Capital Partners, and Citadel had decided to invest alongside him for a total infusion of that $1 billion. I'm told that putting former comptroller of the currency, Joseph Otting, in the CEO role and revamping the board was a boost of confidence for investors to join in here. The price per share of $2 was finalized intraday after the stock plummeted. It's a premium to the lows of today, but below any level that NYCB has closed since the late 90s. Still, the stock is reacting positively because investors believe that the equity stabilizes the bank, whereas the stock moves prior to this announcement were more reflective of a likelihood of failure. Melissa?
I think Mnuchin stepping in is a really interesting twist given his track record bailing out IndyMac during the great financial crisis. At the time, that was the third biggest failure amongst banks in U.S. history. And I guess there's sort of a dance being done in terms of how when to step in, how far do you let New York Community Bancorp fall, and whether or not you just wait until it does.
If you're a public market investor, there's just been such a slew of headlines surrounding this company. It was just last week where they revealed their material weaknesses and internal controls related to loan review. That review is ongoing. So there's been this sense among the investor community of what could pop up next. And that's been the main concern and why they've really struggled to find stability here. They did have a couple weeks of stability. You saw some insider buys. It seemed like things were kind of under control. But now there's just so much uncertainty. So what today's news showed, and I think that's why you saw the stock close up a decent amount today, is that, you know, you have this new management team in place, a management team that is very familiar with the regulatory environment, which is extremely important as this company is now over $100 billion in assets, so regulated much more strictly than they were back in 2022.
Yeah. You've been pouring over this.
Yeah, I find the whole thing, it is fascinating. I think, you know, what Leslie's talking about, the fear of failure, I think we were hours from failure, less than one day from failure. I don't think that this stock could have opened again tomorrow without there having been something cataclysmic. So interesting timing for them to price an equity offering and a convert and the warrants. But I imagine that NYCB had absolutely zero negotiating leverage, none. So this is very good. There's life for the bank. If you know, it was trading as if it was an option that was about to expire. So now there's life to the option. I don't know that it addresses some of the other issues. So we know that they had this goodwill of $2.4 billion. This is going back to last week. That all of a sudden they're saying, all right, you know what? That goodwill should be worth zero. Now, that doesn't actually affect the tangible book value, but it does raise questions of why have you never looked to write down that goodwill before now? I don't know. Maybe it had to do with them talking to Mnuchin and others. It's fascinating. It's good that they're getting new management, particularly after that crazy ride last week where we saw the head of the board step down and say,
in protest,
I don't think he should be our guy, which you brought up the point. Maybe it was because some of the things they bought under him, Flagstar. I don't know. The goodwill didn't change between before Flagstar and after. It didn't change much between when they did the signature deal. So I don't know what the disclosure hasn't been fantastic.
No.
Right? And I also would imagine they were calling Jamie Dimon and he was like, no way, I'm not taking this call.
No, you point out the disclosure aspect, and there's this sense of mistrust among the investor community because remember they lost their head of risk and their head of audit back in December. It was never disclosed. They just kind of disappeared from the website, and then suddenly media reports showed that those two individuals had departed. It took a few weeks to fill those roles.
It was reminiscent of SVB.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And that's why I think when headlines hit the wires earlier today saying that they were looking for equity capital, a lot of people had this deja vu sense of, oh, that's what happened with SVB and they went under and therefore the stock plummeted more than 40% on those headlines when that deal was actually solidified. And they saw that it was $1 billion led by Mnuchin's firm and some other heavyweight investors. The stock rebounded and people felt more comfortable.
And it's that history that almost makes you wonder if I think you're referring to this, Karen. When did they really know about this $2.4 billion impairment? Was Mnuchin already looking over the books? Did he say, hey, I could get involved here, but you've got some work to do before we do that? And obviously, they were in a really difficult place. The thing that's also just interesting to read headlines when you hear announcements from the new team and the investors saying, we actually now feel that New York Community Bank has enough reserves to deal with provisions and parts of the existing portfolio. I don't know how you do that. I mean, in other words, I think there's some dynamics out there. We talked about the idiosyncratic dynamic of New York Community Bank and why, in some sense, this isn't the whole sector, but that they have significant issues in terms of buildings that they own in New York or they've lent against, that have significant rent controls around them. There's a lot of different dynamics with their loan portfolio that I'm not so sure right now, given the concerns that are happening, that you can say, hey, we think we're not only good here, but we're good to be able to deal with additional capital reserves. Fascinating that the KRE closes flat on the day. And if anything, over the last couple of days is in an upswing. And so that's telling you that the market is saying this is NYCB specific. Also, Fed Powell today made a reference to commercial real estate, and he said, manageable. We kind of think it's manageable. That was a great day to say it if you're NYCB trying to get this deal done.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, though, that the problem was they became too big and all of a sudden we're under the regulatory crosshairs. So I wonder if this rattles investors' faith in small caps because, you know, when you think about it, it was doing just fine until it reached a threshold of market cap and, you know, assets that triggered more regulation. So I just find this all so interesting.
But are you saying they were doing just fine or no one knew how not fine they were doing?
I suppose you could say it either way, but it makes you wonder, you know, okay, what about the rest of the regionals or the smaller banks, right?
Who was looking at the loan portfolio? I mean, it's not like it was an unknown that they had a large percentage of loans that were tied to rent-controlled properties.
The regulator forced that deal.
2019 was when the law was passed. We knew that rates were rising for a very long time, the most well-telegraphed rate hiking cycle in the history of man.
But is that in the model? Would you expect that? Obviously it wasn't, right? So we keep expecting these things to all be in the model. So now we flagged another one. That'll be put in to the next model.
But the question is, who else hasn't, you know, put that in the model?
Recount. Well,
what else hasn't been accounted
for? Well, once that happens, the market will trade off of it.
My understanding is that there was almost this kind of regulatory awakening when they crossed that $100 billion threshold. Yeah. Suddenly, they were feeling pressure from the OCC, which hadn't historically regulated them as closely. And so they, the way that they were treating these loans, they, I think they expected more of a phase-in period after they acquired the Signature assets, that they could kind of phase in some of these criticized loans, that it was more of a, you know, okay, well, we did this deal for you guys, so give us a grace period to work this through our books. And then the OCC came in there and was like, no, no, you have to criticize these now. These need to be reflective of a $100 billion bank. There is no phase-in period. You are over this threshold. You need to be acting like it. And so I think that was where the big surprise came in the fourth quarter. They had to take more reserves as a result, slash the dividend. And so it was kind of this almost like a misunderstanding with their regulators on to what they expected following these large acquisitions.
Which also does not instill confidence.
Right. Right, exactly, which yeah. kind of feeds into the whole narrative here. Right.
Leslie, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Leslie Picker, keeping us abreast of all the developments here. For more on what New York Community Bancorp's lifeline means for the battered stock, let's bring in Chris McGratty, head of bank research at KBW, a Stifel company. Chris has a market perform rating on the stock, an outperform not too long ago. And Chris, I want to just start off with where we left it. You know, if New York Community Bancorp had never acquired the assets of a Signature, would we have known about, the problems within their loan portfolio?
Sure. Thanks, Melissa. The problems in the loan portfolio really come down to concentration, right? New York Community has been a concentrated business model in New York City in multifamily apartment buildings forever. That's not new. The Signature deal and the Flagstar deal a year ago actually made them less concentrated, still concentrated, but less so. Really, the issue is they crossed the $100 billion level. And the OCC, while their previously were the regulator, we believe the scrutiny got turned up after the deal. And certainly this phase-in period did not happen.
So was that when the bank announced that it was acquiring those assets, did you think that there was a phase-in period? I'm wondering how there is a misunderstanding about that when you're buying assets and it's a deal that's blessed by the FDIC.
We all did, yeah. We actually upgraded the stock to outperform that night. We thought at $6, given the stock and given the capital relief, this was a great deal. We thought while the company had earnings challenges they were working through, diversification was moving in the right direction. So the phase-in period didn't happen. And certainly we didn't see this. We stepped away from the stock in December, but we certainly didn't see the speed of which this happened transpiring.
So, Chris, it's Karen. Thanks for being on today. So you have a buy on the stock. What is it? How do you model this? What are you hoping they achieve? What are you basing? What kind of metrics are you looking for here?
No, just to be clear, we were buy rated last year. We stepped away in December, so we're market weight the stock. Really, what we're going through, Karen, is we're trying to figure out with all the dilution that happened today, what is the normalized return on equity for the company? The stock closed at roughly 50% of pro forma tangible book, and that would suggest the market's thinking an ROE in the 5-6% range is about right. We're hearing and we're talking to investors a lot about this reminds us of Citigroup from 2008 and the dilution. So the earnings power has certainly been diminished. There is earnings in this company. It's going to take time to come out. And I think today was the capital raise. But going forward, they're not done. They're going to sell assets. They're going to consider securitizations. Those were ideally going to be the first moves the company was going to make after earnings. The market forced their hand to do the equity raise first. But clearly, we're trying to estimate what the earnings power, and it's probably a 5-6 ROE.
Hey, Chris, it's Tim. So who's next? Because you can't tell me that idiosyncratic. I know the New York rent control market's difficult. We can all paint that picture. But it was a year ago that was SVB. It was held to maturity securities and a quick flight of capital that made that a problem. There's some issues out there, and it just seems to me that there are a lot of people that may be over their skis.
Right. Commercial real estate's a big asset class, right? It's 40% roughly of a small bank's balance sheet. So the smaller banks, Tim, have more CRE. So that's where we're spending the focus. And they have lower reserves. So the incremental earnings pressure is going to be felt for the small banks. But if you step back, today was a big step in the right direction for the industry. Confidence has been really, really low. I think investors had feared this was going to be a zero for shareholders. And clearly right now, that's not the case. So we are still thinking about what the normalized impact from credit is. But we don't think there's going to be a systemic concern from here. We've had a year. We're almost at the one-year anniversary of SVB. The industry's liquidity and deposit levels look very, very strong. There are earnings pressures, but systemic, we don't buy into that.
All right. Chris, got to let you go. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Chris McGratty of KBW. Where do you stand on this?
So when you look back on the issues that we had last year, and when things were called a bailout, usually when you have a bailout, you buy the stock and the stock rallies. We didn't see that last year. We saw floods of money coming into money center banks, to a JP Morgan, because they were the one that were solving the problem. Now you have another bailout. So for me, there's plenty of others that are going to be out there. The market's a pretty efficient place. They'll sell the ones that have the same issues. But if you're looking to buy the equity, where do you think it's going to go? The last spring taught us that the equity didn't go anywhere. Look back on some of these names that were troubled back then. The equity didn't go anywhere. Look back on some of the other names. They never got as high as they were before they sold off. Mm-hmm. So all this tells me is buy JP Morgan.
I mean, I think that I kind of agree on the large over small argument. I mean, I think this just bolsters the idea that at least you know exactly what the large banks are doing. They know what the regulatory landscape looks like. They're, you know, potentially lower earnings risk than they have been historically, lower leverage. But I don't know. I think about, you know, real estate back in 2009 and it felt similar. It was the idea that, you know, these companies needed to raise equity. And when they did, they sort of got a lifeline and they bounced a little bit. But then they just kind of remained dead money for a very long period of time. And I wonder if that's the path for regionals. I mean, I think that what's interesting is you need a lender for the economy. And the only area of the economy that hasn't been allowed to lend are the big regulated banks. So I think this is an environment where, you know, you could potentially see that shift.
Right. Did you actually put on the trade that we talked about this afternoon?
I did.
You did.
And then I almost took it off, but I didn't, which was Melissa and I were talking this afternoon about this before the Mnuchin thing. And I'm like, ooh, this looks really bad. I'm going to short some KRE. And then you text me the Mnuchin thing. I'm like, oh, I'm going to look to cover. And then I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to look to cover because this isn't great. Right. And then I thought, oh, should I do a KRE XLF kind of trade? I'm in your camp. I think to the beneficiary of this kind of disruption is the big money center banks.
Right, right. And also we got word from Powell today that they're reexamining the capital plans.
Yeah.
A big boost for the big banks.
There's no question. And we thought 1 year ago that the big banks had their hands tied once again. And I think it was at a time when actually the banks were starting to have a lot more freedom on their capital. I guess I agree with that. I mean, I look at what everybody's saying here. First of all, if you look at the BKX, so the large cap bank, essentially, you know, you double bottomed at 70 on the charts. You're up 40% off of that market inflection. And you're now actually breaking out. And you're breaking out at a time when we are seeing some of the broader dynamics. It's great to have Savita back because I think she even talked about some of the old economy stocks that were going to benefit from the efficiencies of AI. And you're seeing this where people are willing to. It's easy to poo-poo that the EPS growth has been disappointing, but the margin dynamics have been pretty impressive.
All right. Meantime, Fed Chair Jerome Powell also saying in his testimony today that he is confident inflation will continue to move lower, but that more data is needed before the Fed can start cutting rates. Long-term Treasury yields were lower on the day, with the 10-year touching its lowest since February 7th. Let's bring in Paul McCulley, an adjunct professor at Georgetown's McDonough School and former PIMCO chief economist. Paul, always great to see you.
Good to see you.
Did we learn anything new from Powell in terms of the trajectory of rate cuts and or the landing point, the end point?
No, I don't think we learned anything new today. We did get confidence that we heard right back at the last presser and also in his 60 Minutes interview that the tightening cycle's over. He did a valedictory on that. An easing cycle is going to come. He's warm and fuzzy about that, but he's not urgent about starting the easing process. And I think there are a couple reasons. One, the economy is still quite resilient, if not strong. And I think he agrees with that. And we also have the financial markets quite exuberant. So both of those factors say later not sooner. But it's a done deal that we're going to get an easing cycle, and June seems to be a date that that works for the market, works for me. I think it'll work for the Fed.
Hoya Saxa, Professor McCulley from Hoya. I think you have an argument that the Fed's overly restrictive, but it's okay. How about the offset of the financial conditions out there being remarkably easy? Is that making it, you know, an okay environment for the Fed to hang in there longer? And I realize we don't know what the tail is and what the dog is, but if equities were doing something different, would you be more worried about the economy than you are today?
I'm not sure if I'd be more worried about the economy, because I think the equity market really is betting on the easing game, and it does ease financial conditions along with the other components of financial conditions, and that supports the economy. And on one side, that gives the Fed time, because the financial markets are already stimulating or supporting the economy. On the flip side, it requires the Fed to ease in the fullness of time to validate what the market has done. Or if you want to put it very simply, ultimately the Fed's got to reslope the yield curve. An inverted yield curve with easier financial conditions is not a completed project. You ultimately have to have a reslope yield curve. The Fed has to validate it. And assuming that they do, then we will have, you know, the soft landing scenario.
Paul, what's going to be the tell? For me, it's they can't do QT and be cutting rates at the same time. There's too much push-pull there. So once we see them end QT, that gives me the sign that the next go-around is the cut. Do you agree, or why don't you agree?
I actually disagree with that. I think that QT and the policy rate are separate variables. They're separate tools. And I don't think there's any impediment whatsoever to the Fed starting the easing process and continuing QE to QT. And I think QT is going to be tapered maybe even in March, but certainly this spring, so as that they're not at the pace that they've been for the last 18 months.
Paul, thanks for joining us. Always great to see you. Paul McCulley, adjunct professor at Georgetown now. So, Savita, what'd you make of today's testament? Does it change anything? You're already getting more bullish on the markets.
I am, yeah. I mean, I feel pretty good about markets. I think, you know, we've written a lot about how a lot the bear cases that we hear don't necessarily hold water. So, you know, the idea that the market's too expensive. Well, if you compare the S&P today to the S&P in 1980, yeah, it looks more expensive, but it's a completely different animal. It's got, you know, 50% of it is asset light versus 30 years ago, it was more manufacturing. I think, though, what's interesting just from listening to the professor is the idea that we're not going to see another Fed hike. So I think that could be the bearish scenario.
But there is one.
I mean, just, you know, yeah. Inflation, is it under control? Maybe it comes back a little bit. And if we did see another Fed rate hike, I don't think that would be so terrible. What's another 25 basis points? There's, you know, cash-rich investors would make more money on their cash. Tech companies are net cash positive. It would probably be okay from a fundamental perspective. But I just wonder if that's completely off the table. Yeah.
I wonder if it's off the table, both a cut and a raise, just because of the political environment.
Right, exactly.
Whether or not the data supports one of those doesn't matter.
You kind of hope it, right, as a citizen. Yeah. I mean, you know, we have this independent central bank that we don't want to be. So they may not do what they need to do just to show they're independent. But we've got three cuts baked in. I agree.
Coming up, a check on China tech. Shares of JD.com surging after earnings in the broader Chinese internet space is jumping along with it. How to trade these names next, and we are stepping back on the scale to hit the weight loss drug race. How rising costs could impact those in need and how the government could step in. More on that when Fast Money returns.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee, right here on CNBC.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura's been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Wouldn't it be great to have all your investment and retirement accounts in one place? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, makes it easy. I use it to put my investment account and 401k accounts into one hub and get expert tips that help me confidently manage my money. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They're the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Welcome back to Fast Money. JD.com topping the tape today, having its best day in almost 2 years. The Chinese e-commerce company surging more than 16% after posting a beat on the top and the bottom lines. Revenues in the latest quarter rose 3.6% from a year ago. The company also announcing a $3 billion share buyback. There's so many concerns about the competitive threats, which they did seem to acknowledge in some respects, but specifically from PDD, which is the owner of Temu, Shop Like a Billionaire.
It's very competitive. Yeah. And so if you think about that environment, the question is, if you're investing in Chinese e-commerce names and even internet companies more broadly, based upon fundamentals or not, because, again, on fundamentals, if you look at the cash on the balance sheets of JD, and they talked about this buyback, I think Alibaba has somewhere in the nature of $80 billion in cash or equivalents with $180 billion market cap. So, I mean, everything about these companies says buy, buy, buy. And I think the fundamentals are starting to look better on based on this profit dynamic that people can allow them to focus on the names themselves. These are great numbers. These are great numbers. And I think they're coiled springs. I just don't think people are jumping on the other side of that seesaw yet. I've definitely added to Chinese internet names over the last couple of weeks, and I feel like I can own them for the long term and doing that for clients as well.
I mean, the politics around it in terms of what the Chinese government might do, and then also you add the dynamic of an election year, there could be a lot of rhetoric about tariffs and, you know, U.S.-China relations getting worse.
It's the one thing that D.C. agrees on. Yeah. Right. It's a bipartisan issue. Everyone has China in the crosshairs. But if you look at the market, to Tim's point, the market has lost $6 trillion worth of wealth in that market. So can you, if you look at any chart, the charts all unanimously look terrible. Can they bounce from a much lower cost basis? Of course they can. Am I willing to take that risk? I don't think I'm there yet.
All right. There is a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Slimming down your waist and your wallet. Will the rising cost of weight loss drugs impact those most in need? The details on that one ahead. Plus, lifting up, a five-star ride for the stock in today's session, and one of our traders is staying long on this ride, the rideshare tear, next. You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks bouncing back from yesterday's sell-off as investors digested testimony from Fed Chair Jerome Powell. The Dow climbing 75 points. The S&P and NASDAQ both jumped 0.5%. Shares of Brown-Forman sinking 7% after the spirits maker lowered its annual organic net sales forecast. Brown-Forman, the worst performer in the S&P today and turning negative for the year with today's drop. Dexcom, meantime, surging nearly 10% after the FDA cleared the company's first ever over-the-counter glucose monitor patch, which will be available this summer. The patch is designed for patients with type 2 diabetes who do not use insulin, and it is the first glucose biosensor that does not require a prescription. And NVIDIA, this is worth noting, higher yet again today, up 3%, now up nearly 8% just this week. And it's only Wednesday. And gold also glistening today, hitting an intraday all-time high, settling on a new record. And Bitcoin also bouncing back after its big drop yesterday. The crypto touching a new record level of 69,000 before making a sharp downturn to climb back to around $67,000 today. Coming up, a five-star move for one rideshare stock. Lyft surging on the back of some big upgrades this week, and the move has one of our traders adding to his position. Why he is flexing his bicep next. But first, heavy costs in the weight loss drug space, the consumers being impacted. What exactly can be done as the obesity drug battle rages on? The details when Fast Money returns.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. The debate around GLP-1 drug prices and availability rages on, with concerns that ballooning costs could limit access and cost the government billions. Monday, former NEC Director Brian Deese wrote in a New York Times op-ed saying the U.S. government should try to lower prices through its Medicare purchasing program, but not all experts agree that that's the most effective way to control costs and blunt the impact on the federal budget. Former FDA Commissioner and CNBC contributor Dr. Scott Gottlieb joins us now. Scott, great to see you. And we had a very heated discussion surrounding this yesterday. And we also had some question marks around some of the numbers, the eye-popping numbers that Deese had outlined in the op-ed. And you also took issue with some of those numbers. What, in your opinion, did Deese miss?
Well, there's no question this is going to cost Medicare a lot of money, but not nearly what was estimated in that op-ed. First of all, they wrongly used list price to make their assumptions on what the cost would be rather than the net price. We know discounting is very heavy in the market right now, on the order of 40 to 60% between Wegovy and Zepbound. It's only going to get more intense. And also, they wrongly assumed, it appears, that this was approved under a biologics license application. That's a biological. And in fact, it was approved under a new drug application. And therefore, it's already subject to the price negotiation within the IRA, within Medicare. And it's probably going to go on list this year. So it's probably going to be subject to the negotiated price as early as 2027. And some analysts on Wall Street are also estimating that. And so the notion of the op-ed was that we need to extend the price negotiation under the IRA to encompass these drugs, because otherwise they won't be subject to the negotiated price until 2030, they said in the op-ed. And in fact, they'll be subject to the negotiated price as early as 2027, and they'll go on the list probably. Semaglutide will probably go on the list this year based on when it was approved. It was approved in December of 2017. That's 7 years out, and so therefore it's subject to negotiation. Novo is probably regretting that they got it approved in December of 2017 rather than January 2018 because now it's 7 years.
Right. He should have, Deese should have talked to some of the analysts on Wall Street who are already factoring in 27 being the year in which it would go on the Medicare list in terms of up for negotiation. I'm wondering, though, Scott, because, you know, you mentioned Ozempic specifically. Wegovy was approved later on for weight loss specifically. And so is there a difference in terms of what is able to be negotiated in terms of what the use of the molecule is?
So the price negotiation, the negotiated rate is going to be applied to semaglutide, so it's going to encompass all the formulations. And so presumably, based on how Medicare has behaved in other settings similar to this, they're going to extend that not just to the formulation for diabetes, Ozempic, but also the formulation for weight loss, Wegovy. So that, too, will be subject to the negotiated price as early as 2027.
How do you think about the gains, though, to society that Deese didn't really factor in, that a lot of other people are thinking more broadly about? I mean, theoretically, if you're not having a serious cardiovascular event, you're not missing work, for instance, or if you're not in need of knee surgery because you're not obese, you're not missing work either.
Yeah, it's not just the productivity benefits that we're going to see from this, but also the direct health benefits. And mm-hmm. they could be quite substantial. There's a lot of comorbidity inside the Medicare population related to weight. And it also underscores the fact that a lot of people are going to be newly eligible for these drugs even before Medicare expands coverage for weight loss. And so their assumption in the op-ed was that once Medicare expands coverage for weight loss, then all these patients will be newly eligible for the drug. And in fact, as new indications get on the labels of these drugs, and Wegovy's probably going to get an indication for cardiovascular risk reduction this year, those patients will become eligible for the drug, because even though Medicare doesn't cover drugs for weight loss, they do cover drugs for cardiovascular risk reduction. And if you look at the numbers right now, there's about 23 million Medicare beneficiaries that have had a prior stroke or MI. If you figure half of them are already eligible for this drug because they have diabetes, and then half of the remaining patients probably qualify based on BMI, that gets you to around 5 to 6 million patients who will be newly eligible under Medicare for Wegovy once it gets that label expansion, probably this year. And the total population of Medicare patients who would be eligible just based on BMI alone is probably roughly around 20 million. So 25% of that population will be eligible just based on the label expansion this year. And it's only going to increase as they get indications for sleep apnea, chronic kidney disease, and other comorbidities.
Hey, Scott, it's Tim. Thanks, and thanks for putting numbers to that, because the Deese op-ed, you know, some people just think a lot of this is politics. Your views on the political season and the two parties going toe-to-toe, give your thoughts on drug pricing proposals from each side. I think what you believe might surprise some people.
Well, I do think that this op-ed was probably a walk-up to the State of the Union, where the president's likely to announce a dramatic or a proposed dramatic expansion of the Inflation Reduction Act and the negotiated prices to a broader segment of drugs. And they've already put that in the budget, so I think a lot of that's been previewed. I think the scuttlebutt inside the community, the pharmaceutical community, if you will, is that the proposals put forward by former President Trump actually could have a more dramatic impact on the industry than the proposals being put forward by President Biden in terms of an expansion of the IRA. First of all, I think most people don't expect the expansion of the IRA to actually be enacted. I think the presumption is that the Republicans probably get control of the Senate, regardless of what happens with the House and the presidency. But if President Trump were to win, even if there was a Democratic Senate, and it's unlikely that there'd be a Democratic Senate, what he's proposing is to index prices in Medicare to European drug prices. And if they don't adjust that for GDP per capita and they apply it retrospectively, so they apply it to already marketed drugs rather than prospectively just to drugs that are newly launched, that could have a dramatic one-time effect on the pharmaceutical industry's revenue. And when they proposed that in the past as a regulation, they did apply it retrospectively, so to already marketed drugs. And that would have a very dramatic effect. And I think, quite frankly, it's probably more likely to pass because Republicans would support it because they'd want to support the president, and Democrats would support it because they want to take money away from the drug industry.
Dr. Gottlieb, thanks for being on. Do you think that we could see this not being a duopoly in, I don't know, 2 years or so, and that that would also decrease the pressure on pricing?
Well, certainly. And also, these companies have follow-on molecules in development. They're probably more than, you know, a couple of years away. They're going to have pivotal data probably next year. And so you probably wouldn't see approval until maybe 2026. But I think there's also going to be competition from oral formulations of drugs where patients could get cycled off of some of these injectables once they achieve some initial weight reduction and get maintained on some of the oral drugs, including the oral drugs that are currently in the market. I think doctors are going to find different ways to manage these patients so they're not necessarily on these injectables in perpetuity. But as these labels expand, you're going to see pretty intense, I believe, price competition between Lilly and Novo here. This isn't just a battle of which is the best drug, but which drug has the best label. And for a time, Novo is probably going to have the better label because they're going to get that SELECT trial data into their label, the evidence for cardiovascular risk reduction. And so in order to compete, Lilly's probably going to have to discount more because Novo is going to have the better label for perhaps a year until Lilly turns over the card on the trials they have in CHF and sleep apnea and maybe get approvals for those indications sometime in 2025.
Scott, always great to see you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Dr. Scott Gottlieb, were you long, Lilly? No.
So, no, I was long Amgen, and I'm out of Amgen. It was part of my wage, and I'm actually only long still two of those letters in the in that acronym. So when you look at a Novo or you look at a Lilly, it definitely is a two-party race at this point, and you see how difficult Amgen had a time of doing it, and they lost. So I think it's still theirs.
Yeah. Are you starting to think about the impact on productivity and even the economy in terms of your stock market forecast?
In terms of just the GLP-1 drugs. GLP-1s. Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. I think it's obviously it's going to change a lot of factors, like the need for prosthetics, and you know, just I think the array of possibilities is wide. What I find really fascinating, though, is we've seen this movie before. Every presidential election year, where we start the year with a big overweight in healthcare, and let me tell you, when you look at the holdings of mutual funds, hedge funds, everyone, pharma. Like, these stocks are the core holdings of your average fund manager. This is, I just feel like this is such a setup for healthcare, where it's, you know, you always, you get this tweet, you get Medicare for all, you get, you know, something happens during campaign season. So this makes me think that we're not necessarily positioning for the election yet.
All right. Coming up, why Tim is going all in on the L in Blycep. The rideshare stock lifting his spirits this year. He'll lay out why he thinks he's primed for even more gains.
Pretty happy right there.
And meantime, Foot Locker shares falling off a cliff today, down nearly 30%. The major headline that has investors scrambling for a foothold right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of Lyft jumping 8.5% today, now up nearly 17% in the past week. But even with these gains, it's not quite back at its recent post-earnings high. Lyft, of course, is part of Tim's newly modified
It just rolls off the tip of your tongue.
Yeah. Bicep, which is not a real word, obviously. He's adding to his position today, so why?
It's amazing the flexibility we're given in the acronym game. And I need it, by the way, because I think I'll take anything I can get. I'm a little behind here. My view is on Lyft. There's a couple big picture dynamics with both transportation as a service and mobility. And you talked about it, a duopoly, essentially, in GLP land. Well, I mean, you know, Uber and Lyft, there's a significant difference in where they trade. And if you, you know, there's probably a reason for that. But the profitability and the numbers that they showed for those 4Q numbers, the fact that they're executing on cost savings and efficiency, the fact that some of the tailwinds from additional drivers, so they've got 25% more drivers, they had 47% more supply of driver available hours. These were things that were killing this company during the kind of the post-COVID normalization process. I just think some of this is a combination of there's a 12% short interest in the stock. The company's had a couple good quarters of numbers. The street has absolutely proved me on this. Every analyst says, these are good numbers. I want to see another quarter or two of this. But you know, to me, this is a case where this is a $30 stock before it's a $14 stock, I think. And I think it's a combination of valuation discount to Uber, that they've gotten their act right, but the tailwinds for the industry are great, and there's only two players. So I like Lyft, and I've been adding to a position over the last 3 or 4 months.
Where are you on 30 over 14?
It sounded great when it rolled off his back. I was agreeing.
It's confident.
It was extremely confident. When you look at the chart, it's a terrible chart longer term. But when you look at the performance against Uber, it's been outperforming Uber or very close to Uber on a longer term. I like Uber because you're looking at a huge mammoth company. And Lyft is a very small company in relationship to Uber. Uber's got a lot more levers to pull. So when they don't perform here, they could perform for something else. They'll get the benefit of the doubt. But coming from such a low price and being beaten up for so long, I could see where he's excited about the stock.
All right. Coming up, two left feet for Foot Locker as a sneaker retailer plummets after its latest earnings. How long the company now expects before turning a profit, and how investors are untying from this one. That is next. More Fast Money in 2. Welcome back to Fast Money. Foot Locker getting kicked in the teeth. Shares plummeting nearly 30% after the retailer reported a holiday quarter loss. The sneaker retailer also issuing weak guidance, saying the profitability goal laid out last March will now be delayed by 2 years. The company has been in the midst of a turnaround under former Ulta boss Mary Dillon. Shares had been up 10% on the year before today's loss. Karen, you were a big fan.
Well, it was in my last year's trade, which if I still had, it would make this year's trade phlegm, which is, I'm happy that that's not the case for a couple more reasons. I do still have a small position, actually a fairly smaller position today after this, but I think that it's a little misleading. This was their plan for 26. They've moved it out to 28. So it's not like this was supposed to be the plan for 24. Mm-hmm. But anyone who's been following this story, like I have for the last year, knows that that 26 was not happening, right? They still had too much inventory. She was still in the middle of a, and still is in the middle of a big change out of malls into more superstores, a big capital expenditure. She's trying to do a lot of different things and digital. So she put out a new earnings of between, I don't know, around $1.50 in the midpoint. So the stock here at 15 and a half times for a turnaround that still hasn't shown, it still hasn't shown legs to the extent that it should have. Is not overly compelling here.
Actually. What percent is Nike, are Nike sales of their total revenue at this point? 60s?
No, lower than that. And it has been lower for that. That's right. Not a new part of the story. And there's a lot of strength elsewhere. I mean, On and Hoka and New Balance.
How long do you stick with this trade?
I feel like I'm kind of, I don't have a big position now. Now, I keep these things around just to make me feel bad when they go down and not feel good when they go up. It's working. Right. Mission accomplished. So, no, it's a, yeah, but it's a small bet. I'll feel bad if it, you know, gets taken out tomorrow.
Can you spell phlegm?
Not in the real way.
It's a great spelling bee word.
It really is.
It's a very good acronym.
Karen's very smart.
Playing a xylophone.
We got to go. Final trades up next. Time for the final trade, Savita.
I like XLE energy. I think it's we're entering driving season. Everybody hates energy. It didn't work at all. Love that.
Great to have you here tonight, Savita. Tim?
Great having Savita, and great having Savita say she's not going to go on any other shows on CNBC but Fast Money, which is great.
I didn't hear
silver has been underperforming gold, SLV.
Karen?
Yes, I still like EWW for onshoring and nearshoring into Mexico.
Grasso.
JetBlue back to that level where we saw that Carl Icahn headline.
All right, thanks for watching Fast. See you back here tomorrow at 5. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
Picture this. You're on a John Deere compact tractor, enjoying the sun as you clear brush across your pasture. You just have to get in the seat. Learn more at johndeere.com/get in the seat or visit a dealer near you.